in the Truth About Cars podcast, we're trying to answer the biggest question the auto industry is facing right now. Have we hit peak EV? I'll be joined by BJ Burtwell, the founder and CEO of Electrify Expo, to talk about why he thinks the future is electric. Plus, Alex Nizek from Consumer Reports joins us to discuss their 10 best cars of 2024. It's all up next, but first, a word from our sponsor. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Your elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive entirely its own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with guaranteed fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only and exclusions apply. We're here in the Truth About Cars podcast with BJ Burtwell, the CEO of Electrify Expo. And BJ, before we get into the meat of our chat today, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the automotive industry?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm a car guy. I mean, that's how it all started. I loved tweaking and tuning on cars, throwing money into cars that I would never get back, making them go faster and look cooler. All in all, I was a car guy. And one of my first jobs while I dropped out of college for temporarily was I landed a job at Meguiar's. So Meguiar's is a car care company. They make cleaners and polishes and waxes and have been doing that for, over 100 years. If you're not using Meguiar's, I don't know what you're using. And I started answering phones, customer service guy, talking to people about their paint finishes and how to correct them and how to remove scratches and remove oxidation. And that was my first kind of foray into the aftermarket. And I already liked cars at that time, but then I really got bit by the bug because Meguiar's is just so active in special events and doing things within the grassroots enthusiast community, which was so much fun to watch. But it was mostly classic car guys and kind of Pebble Beach, Congo de Elegance people. And what I noticed when I was there a few years in, it's like, hey, there's an emergence happening within sport compact car culture and import car culture that, you know, there's not a leading car care brand here. And so I pitched the upper management. I mean, I was in my early 20s at the time. It was mid 90s before Fast and Furious and all that. I said, hey, we need to go after youth culture. And for the next, 15 years of my career, I spent most of my time working with brands on helping them reposition themselves to more of a youth culture or, you know, multicultural culture. And so I went from Meguiar's to Chrysler. And I worked at Chrysler headquarters, although I was based out of Southern California for about 7 or 8 years and worked on the LX chassis, which was the brand new Dodge Charger, Chrysler 300, Dodge Magnum at the time. And those were really hot. Yeah, those were super hot cars. And so my job was to help reposition those cars to be a little bit more hip and youthful. And so we did a lot within custom car culture and kind of, you know, when you saw Chrysler 300s and music videos and those 300s were slammed on 22s, that was me. That was me. It was a lot of fun. And so I've just kind of carried that love of car all the way to where I am now, Electrify, which is kind of a polarizing thing because I hated EVs. Absolutely was against them, really felt like, hey, they lacked a soul. You know, it's basically an appliance on wheels. And that's how I looked at them. And, you know, I was on the freeway and behind an EV and I'm like, oh man, I could never get behind the wheel of an EV. And then I did. and then everything changed for me. My first, EV experience, I think it was 2016, or 17, right around that time. And I had no idea that an EV had that type of torque and acceleration. And it just absolutely created a light switch moment for me where it was like, hey, I know there's other people like me who may be skeptical about EVs, and they just need a true experience in an EV in order for them to have their light switch moment. And that was the genesis of Electrify Expo.
That actually brings me, it's a nice segue to my next question. So what is Electrify Expo and what prompted you to launch it? When did you start it and how has it grown? So that's actually a multi-part question, but you can go ahead and answer that.
Well, we're still a young company, but we're in our fourth season in 2024, and we are North America's largest EV festival. So we take over 1 million square feet in 8 cities around the country, and we produce an entirely outdoor EV festival where people can experience all things electric. So it's not just electric cars and electric trucks, although obviously that's a big component of it. but it's also e-bikes, scooters, skateboards, watercraft, solar, battery, EV chargers. I mean, everything electric. When somebody walks into our festival, they might not know about what it means to go electric, but when they leave our festival, they know exactly what it means. And typically they've been bit by the bug because we provided them that experience that they were missing. And that's what's happening right now. In fact, I just saw Chris Hardo over at Consumer Reports a couple weeks ago post an article about how there's just really a lack of experiences out there for people to have their light switch moments in NDV. And that's exactly what Electrify Expo is solving, is we're creating these huge experiences all around the country. You know, we'll do 250,000 demos this year just with EVs. And those are all people who are mostly having their EV driving experience for the very first time, and they're having their light switch moment. So it's catching on. You know, we have so many auto manufacturers and bike and scooter and e-mobility manufacturers involved, and now non-endemics like Amazon and others. So it's just really been a festival that's had a really steep trajectory of growth, and it's really the antithesis to the traditional auto show.
You already touched on this a little bit as you gave us your background, but what got you excited about EVs as an individual? Was it what you already said, or was there more to it than that?
It was the driving experience for me. You know, everybody's different. Like, we're as an industry, we're going through waves of consumers. And so over the last 4 or 5 years for me personally, as I've been involved in the industry, and in some cases I'm still a noob, but you know, we've gone through this wave of EV enthusiasts and early adopters of EVs who didn't require, you know, a ton of convincing to go electric. And I feel like we've moved through them, and now we're into this phase of a mainstream, you know, general consumer who's coming to Electrify Expo to experience this quote all electric thing or this electric thing. And that's kind of how I was. I had heard about it. I was skeptical on it. I didn't really like the idea of, me being told I had to go electric. Like, that wasn't a thing that resonated with me, and that created even more skepticism in me. But when I had my experience in an EV, like, that's when everything changed. When I put my hands on the wheel and my foot on the accelerator and I mashed it, like, for me, that's what changed it. So, you know, starting Electrify Expo was all about, okay, how do we create these experiences or similar experiences for consumers that were like me across the entire e-mobility spectrum? And that's what we're doing.
So that'll bring us kind of into the more meat of our conversation here. So have we hit what people call peak EV, or more specifically, why do you think EVs are the future? Is it necessities such as government mandates or that sort of thing, or is there more to it?
Well, there's no necessities. Like, I believe in free market capitalism, and EVs need to duke it out in the sandbox with gas cars. And people need to, on their own, make their decision about, do I want to go gas or stay gas, or do I want to go electric? That's kind of my opinion on how this works. You know, electric may not be for everyone, but electric is for a lot of people. And people may not know electric is is for them until they actually experience it. And so that's the whole point, is like, hey, look, you may not think about the thrill of driving electric, or you may not think about the benefits of going electric, but like, let's just get you behind the wheel and let's show you. Then at that point, like, sometimes, oftentimes, there is a script that's flipped, and then people are like, hey, I like this idea of going electric. Maybe I don't need to go full electric. Maybe I need to go plug in. Plug-in hybrid, and certainly that's an excellent option for a lot of people. And we can dive into why fully electric is not the best solution for a lot of people. But no, I don't think it's a necessity for these things to happen. I just think that EVs are a different way of moving around, and people need to have a free choice to say, hey, I want to go electric. This experience changed me, or hey, I want to stay gas. But I think eventually, as brands like ours and others do a great job of really providing experiences, I think more and more people will see the benefits of going electric. And many obviously will be converting from gas and never go back to gas again, like I did. I'll never go back to gas.
So on that note, and you know, we've seen EV market share grow and grow over the years. But when do you think EVs will really hit the mainstream, and why? Is it going to be a matter of increased range, lower MSRPs, easier charging access, that sort of thing? But when do you think EVs will really become part of the mainstream market, more so than they already are?
Yeah, I mean, my answer to that is I don't know, but I have an opinion on it.
Mm-hmm. Opinions are absolutely welcome.
I think if you're a two-car family, and you have the ability to charge at home, there is no reason why, at least right now, one of those cars should not be electric. Okay, so mm-hmm. that starts to answer this idea of when will EVs go mainstream? And EV infrastructure needs to catch up and allow for people who aren't able to charge at home to have reliable places to charge quickly so that people can move around and not be worried about running out of battery or running out of range. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is kind of a question that's best answered by let's develop more of the EV infrastructure. Let's see a lot of that come up online. And then as that starts to happen, I think, yes, we will start to, reach that moment, that critical mass moment. But we're still a few years away from that. And I think this is really an exciting time, because over the next few years, there's going to be still a very steep trajectory of growth within the EV world, new people adopting EVs. And so we're not there yet, but as we inch each year, towards 2030, I could see us, at that point being a lot closer to, EVs finally hitting this air quotes, mainstream adoption goal.
Right, right. And mainstream is a little bit of a probably a vague definition anyway. So on that note too, how much do you think, Tesla gets a lot of attention, negative, positive, very kind of, a lot of spotlight on Tesla. How much is Tesla responsible for helping EVs grow? One thing we really can't argue about, no matter what you say about Tesla as a brand or Elon Musk as a person, obviously for a little while, Tesla got a lot of attention. And how much has Tesla really helped grow the EV segment?
Well, what would you say? What would be your answer to that question regarding, how influential or impactful Tesla's been to the EV role? What would you think?
I would say there's definitely been an impact, just because especially a while ago, before we started learning some more negative things about the brand, I think about 5 to 10, 15 years ago, Tesla sort of made EVs look cool in a way that other automakers hadn't. So I would think there definitely is an impact. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, though.
Yeah, I don't even think I would be fortunate to have this conversation with you today if it wasn't for Tesla, because Tesla moved, in my opinion, Tesla moved every auto manufacturer that much quicker to electric.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think they pushed the legacy automakers a little bit too. Mm-hmm.
So there's no way I would have launched a festival like this if there wasn't a demand for EVs, and Tesla has created the awareness and the demand. So I think that they're pretty much solely responsible for pushing the entire industry this quickly into EVs. So, I think that they're the reason.
Yeah, I would agree to an extent. I definitely think legacy automakers would have got there, but they got there a little bit quicker because of Tesla and competition.
They definitely got there quicker because of Tesla. I think the question is the manufacturers are motivated to compete, and they're motivated to win market share. So if the market share really isn't there, what's going to motivate a manufacturer to really get involved? Tesla has created this whole market. They haven't created the EV market, but they've created this motivation for other auto manufacturers to quicken or hasten their EV strategies. I think that we'd probably be a tenth of where we are right now if Tesla was never created. I just don't think that there would be this desire to move away from, legacy oil and gas into a new technology when it's too comfortable and too it's too close to us. It's too common. So do you know what I mean by that?
I think so.
Like for the auto manufacturers, they know the combustion engine route, and There's you know, really no new technology. It's predictable. I guess that's the word I was looking for. It's very predictable.
And I think. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I think you're trying to say that in terms of manufacturing, it's just easy to go with what you know. It costs less money and less time, and bringing in new technology in was probably a little bit of a challenge. And I think the automakers may have moved a little quicker because of Tesla's competition. Was that fair to say?
Yeah, that's what I absolutely want to say. And I think disruptors like Tesla are scary. You know, they're scary to the legacy brands. Especially when they start to catch on steam, and the fan base that they've created over the last decade and a half. So, you know, and I feel like in some ways, you know, from a disruption standpoint, like Electrify Expo is disrupting some things. You know, people have been used to going to traditional auto shows and experiencing vehicles the same way for decades. And now we've disrupted the space because we really felt like, you know, look, auto shows are not the ideal way to experience a new technology like EVs. Like if it's a gas car, no problem. I think it totally makes sense. But to really feel the thrill of going electric and really get the most out of an EV driving experience, that's not going to happen in the basement of a convention center. And so when you juxtapose that against, you know, an outdoor festival that has vibe and atmosphere and music and all of these very entrepreneurial, innovative manufacturers along with legacy manufacturers, where you can really experience these products in a fully new setting, but really experience them like you would in the real world. We're disrupting as well. So, I think that it's important to disrupt legacy industries with new ideas. It's just most of the time disruptors don't make it. So, you know, Tesla has been an example of a disruptor who has figured it all out. And kudos to them. I mean, look, Tesla is at every single one of our festivals, and they started to participate with us last year. And they don't do events, Tim. Like, you know, the line with Tesla, like they don't spend any money on advertising.
Yeah.
Right. Like we all knew that. We know it from a PR standpoint. We know it from an advertising standpoint. The company line is they don't do that. And I believe we were one of, or if not like the only tour that they were participating in. And it's when you watch Tesla activate at our events, they are a different breed. They're a different breed of person. They are totally sold in to the mission of Tesla and the importance of going electric. And when you have that sort of enthusiasm and passion being broadcasted on consumers as they walk into your display, it's infectious. And so, you know, although they don't have a ton of event experience, their passion and devotion to their brand and the industry is felt by people, not just in their main display, but also on their demos. So it's a really interesting thing to watch.
Excellent. So I'm going to kind of flip the script a little bit and ask a couple of questions about EV adoption and sort of go in the opposite direction of what we were just talking about. So why do you think people are... I should rephrase this. Why do you think the people who are hesitant to buy an EV, why do you think they are so hesitant? What is the reason for that?
There could be a lot of valid reasons and invalid reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, people respond differently to being told to do something. Some people are very accepting and they're like, okay, let's do this. This seems like the best thing, the right thing to do. Other people, as soon as you tell them to do something, they're like, well, why are you telling me to do this? And I think that, you know, there have been initiatives and messaging that's come down from government administrations who actually are now flip-flopping on a lot of things that we can surely get into. But, you know, they've been telling states, and they've been working with states, and states have been telling people, hey, we're going to stop doing this in 2025. We're going to stop doing this in 2030. And I think with some people that just does not resonate. Like we're we're Americans. Like, we believe in free choice, and people should be given a choice to go electric or to stay gas. I want people to experience electric. Don't get me wrong, but people should have a choice. So I suppose, you know, that's one reason, is just general skepticism. There are other reasons that are invalid, but there are other reasons that are valid. I mean, I think that this is a new technology. EV infrastructure is not where we need it to be in order to have mainstream adoption. And in some places in this country, and in some living situations, it probably doesn't make sense for that person to go electric. Or it might make sense for them to go plug in. So I think that there are very, you know, there are valid reasons for people sometimes right now at this point in time to maybe go plug in or not go electric. And then there's, you know, some other things that are happening that are kind of beyond our control, that are invalid, and we just need to get to the truth.
Excellent. Excellent. And I would say, I would add to that, that Americans really don't like being told to do, even when it's good for them. We kind of discovered that during the COVID pandemic, but that's a whole different topic. yeah. So this sort of plays into what you just said in answering the previous question, but what are the biggest myths about EVs that some of the adoption maybe being held back because people believe these myths? So can you run us through some of the biggest myths and how you counter those?
Yeah, that's a big one. People still look at EVs, unfortunately, the same way they may have looked at them 3, 4, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult and challenging because the technology is changing so quickly year over year. And so re-educating is a hard thing to do. Like it's a simple thing to plant an idea in someone's mind through an experience or through a message, but to change someone's perception is entirely different and usually a lot more expensive. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, as this technology changes year over year, it is becoming, you know, more difficult because these vehicles do have more range. They do charge faster. There are more EV charging stations. There is less of a need for ranging. There is less of a reason for range anxiety. These cars are cheaper. You know what I mean? But if you look at the opposite of everything I just said, many, many people believe in the opposite because that's what they've been told 3, 4 years ago, and they're taking that with them today. So I think that there are a lot of myths out there that need to be kind of need to be busted. And then, as I mentioned earlier, like there's also just really bad experiences. You know, there's bad experiences that happen at auto shows where people are hyped up because they have a friend who owns an EV and they say, hey, you got to go try this out and check this out. And then they go to an auto show and they hop behind the wheel of something and it's in the basement of a convention center and they're underwhelmed. And then they leave that experience saying, I tried this whole electric thing and I'm not all that impressed. And then when will they ever try an EV again? You know what I mean? So it's, I think that there's a lot of things that factor into this, but it's inevitable that over the next couple of years, as the technology gets stronger and better, which it's already done, as EV infrastructure and the investment going into the industry continues to roll out in a bigger way, it's inevitable that more and more people are going to cross over because the driving experience in an EV is just better. It's just better. And for me, like as a car guy, that's hard for me to say because I love the rumble of a V8 and I love the sing of an inline four turbo. Like I love it. But the actual driving experience, the tranquility, but also the acceleration is something that you just can't replicate in a gas vehicle. And I just feel like the more opportunities we give people to have that experience, the faster mass EV adoption will come.
Excellent. We have time for two more questions, or actually three more questions, and we're going to run through those real quick here. So you've already touched on this a little bit with the previous conversation over the last couple minutes, but what is the one thing that you think is holding back most people from owning an EV, whether it's price, particularly MSRP, range or range anxiety or charging availability, or is it just a matter of there's just not enough EVs in the market that people are getting what they need? You know, they might be willing to go EV in terms of they might be willing to pay for it and range won't bother them, but they're not getting the product that fits them the way they need for their daily lives. So what do you think is the one thing that's kind of holding the market, the EV segment back, or holding people back from owning an EV, I should say?
I don't know, maybe one or two things, but I think you nailed one of them. I think product mix is part of it. You know, look, the best-selling vehicle in America is a pickup truck. So, you know, the more pickup trucks that we have that are electric, the the quicker we're going to get to mass adoption. And unbelievably, most people don't use a pickup truck the way that we stereotypically think about it. Meaning from a utility standpoint, certainly there are many that do. But like if we're talking, an F-150 or a Silverado or a Ram truck, obviously the F-150 Lightning is out and about. But, you know, we're still waiting on Silverado really to roll mm-hmm. out, and we're waiting on the Ram electric truck. We have Cyber that just came out. We have the Rivian truck and trucks that are coming out. So I think that's going to help. So I think product mix is one of them. I mean, Americans love trucks. Americans also love three-row SUVs. And there aren't a ton of three-row SUVs out there. There are some, but there are not a lot. So I think, you know, the more that our product mix broadens and widens, I think that's gonna help quite a bit.
And to the previous question, I think price plays a part as well. And do you think we'll see a $25,000 MSRP EV anytime soon?
I don't know. What's the average price of a gas car these days?
I'm sorry. Way more than $25,000. I want to say the ATP, it changes all the time. I haven't looked in recent days, but probably the mid to high 40s right now. But that's average transaction price. So obviously luxury yeah. vehicles and anything gets marked up is going to skew the number a little bit. But right now, yeah, it's in the 40s for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, look, 5 years ago, there really wasn't price parity in the market. EVs were, in some cases, significantly more expensive on the average than a gas vehicle. But today, you know, there's quite a few really good offerings in that 30K range and 40K range. And then you add on the government rebates. So I don't know if price is what's holding people back. I think in some cases, yes, absolutely. And would a $25,000 offering do well? Yes. I think what is probably going to disrupt our industry next is some of the Chinese and Korean manufacturers entering the U.S. market because they may be able to enter the U.S. market at a lower price point than what is offered right now. So that's going to shake things up and certainly make things affordable. Now, whether Americans will gravitate to those vehicles and not care so much about brand awareness, because a lot of these brands are not known by general Americans, we'll have to wait and see. But I don't think it's price, although it plays a factor. I just don't think it's the main factor. I could be wrong.
Excellent. So, but just to follow up on that, do you think we will see anything in that price range anytime soon, or is that still a little bit ways off?
Yeah, I think we will. I mean, I don't know if Tesla is going to be the first to do it, but I think we're going to see it. And like I said, it may come over from overseas, and it's probably going to come, you know, in the next, you know, 12 to 24 months.
Excellent. Thank you for your time. It's been a great conversation today. So finally, how can people find out more about Electrify Expo?
You can find out more about Electrify Expo by hitting us up on any of our socials. We have great content and videos, all types of first-time experiences that we publish from people at our festivals. So all the major social media platforms, as well as electrifyexpo.com.
Just for the benefit of our listeners, you want to go ahead and kind of give out your social handles there?
Sure. Instagram and Facebook, you can find us at Electrify Expo, same with Twitter. And then obviously electrifyexpo.com, you can come look at our 8 festivals this year. We hit Orlando and then Phoenix, LA, San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, Austin, and New York. So we're making our way around the country and continue to add more festivals. So if you're in that region, or even if you want to check us out, it's really worth the time to come and even fly in and have a spend a great day with your family at Electrify Expo.
Awesome. Thanks for your time. We are speaking with BJ Burtwell, the CEO of Electrify Expo, and we'll be right back on the Truth About Cars podcast. eBay Motors is here for the ride. So speaking of rides, last week we talked about watching racing from the stands. this week we're talking about, or I'll be talking about myself anyway, about my first chance to drive on a racetrack at speed, which was about 15 or 16 years ago at Road America in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, about an hour north of Milwaukee. That was my first chance at an industry event to drive at speed on a racetrack. I've done that several times. I've done Road America almost every year since, except for the COVID year. Unfortunately, I've even had an incident where I've gone off at Road America, which you could read about on The Truth About Cars. I've also had the chance to drive Thunderhill in California, near Sacramento, Willow Springs in Southern California, Sonoma Point, which is the old Sears Point Raceway. I don't know what it's being called these days. Changed names several times. I've driven Sonoma Point a few years ago, and I actually will be driving it again in about a month or so. I actually take that back, just a couple of weeks. So I've driven Sonoma Point a couple, or Sears Point Sonoma Raceway a couple of times, driven a few other private tracks, Autobahn in the Chicago suburbs, a few others here and there, Spring Mountain out in Nevada. And I've also, of course, like most automotive journalists, I've had the chance to drive Gingerman in Southwest Michigan, which is a great fun track. So for those of you listening, get on track if you can. And if you need help, that's where eBay Motors comes in. Where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly with brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Motors Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber and not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Here at the Truth About Cars podcast, we like to speak about the products that we use on our vehicles at home, in terms of keeping them running and keeping them running well, keeping them clean, and all the other sort of good stuff that you do to maintain your car at home. So we're speaking with Matthew Guy today. Matthew Guy is one of our kind of stuff we call him our stuff we use expert, because he actually uses a lot of the products that we review on the site. So Matthew, we're talking about socket wrench sets today. Can you walk us through the best, the worst, and all that sort of stuff? Let's start with your preferred. Let me try that again in English, please. Let's start with your preferred socket set.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, we thought this would be a great idea for our listeners to follow up on. We've been talking about floor jacks. We've been talking about other garage useful tools. So, you know, a socket set is a natural evolution of that. But it is a bit more of an investment for sure. So It's good to have a bit of knowledge in your back pocket before you go out and spend the money on it. If you're new to wrenching, or if you're just getting back into it, remember that just try to avoid sets. I don't like sets which pad their so-called piece count with tiny or nearly useless tools. Almost every socket set that you see for sale will say, hey, this is 135 pieces, or this is 206 pieces. And sometimes they'll pad that count with like 48 screwdriver bits that you'll never use. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So That is something that you can watch out for. You might think that you're getting a lot more than you actually are if you're just going by the piece count. So make sure to look and see what's actually in the case before you buy it. And here's what I feel you should be looking for. I've got a 135 piece Craftsman mechanic set with metric and standard in them. And that's been in my toolbox for the better part of a decade. And its case was far more battered than ever. I actually took the plastic case. It's just a blow mold of plastic case. And I actually took it apart because I leave it in my tool chest at home. I don't take this one with me anywhere where I go. So I just leave that in the in my tool chest. So I've actually taken the blow molded case apart so that I can still keep all of my sockets James May style, put everything back where it belongs, right?
And
you should always look for, I feel, six sided sockets. What I mean by that is the sockets themselves that you're using to undo bolts will have six sides on them. Most bolts have six sides, so it is a much better option to have a six sided socket. Why, you ask? Because there are also 12-sided sockets out there, because they're good in a pinch, but they'll often round out the head of the bolt. Hey, Tim, I mean, you've been in the parts industry for a long time back in the day, and you experienced this too, right?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Seen it happen for sure.
And you just ended up with rounded out bolts, and then you're using.
Oh yeah, it's frustrating.
Totally frustrating. So definitely look for something that doesn't pad its piece count with small screwdriver bits or hex keys and stuff like that. A few of those are fine, but if there's 100 of them in there, it's not really going to add to your day very much. What would you call it? The point of diminishing returns, I guess. And look for something with six pointed sockets. I also like to have enough deep well sockets. If you look at particular sockets that come with these sets, some of them will only be a couple of inches high, and then some others will be double that amount. And I call those deep well sockets. I'm sure other people have different names for them. But it just allows you to either get down into something a little bit better, whether you need the extra reach, or maybe it's a longer bolt where the head is in a weird spot. And those deep well sockets are really, really helpful.
Excellent. Are there any sets or types you would recommend buyers and stay at home at home mechanics, shade tree mechanics? That's what I was looking for, shade tree. Would you anything you'd recommend they avoid?
Definitely avoid anything with 12 points in them.
Outside of
Try
12 points,
to,
which we already discussed, of course.
yeah, and then try to avoid ones that you might find, say, and I know this sounds simplistic, but it's true. These types of sets often show up in bargain stores, you know what I mean? Or major retailers that don't necessarily specialize in car repair. So if they're in a major retailer that doesn't specialize in car repair, or if it's in a discount store, in a discount a supermarket or a department store is whatever the term I'm looking for, try not to buy them there because they tend to be not great quality. They'll either round your bolts off, or, and this is something that I've seen most in those cheap sets, is the ratchet itself doesn't have enough teeth in the head of the ratchet. And what I mean by that, that refers to the number of cogs on the gears that's inside that tool. It makes that cool sound, right? The brr, brr, brr that you hear when you're using a ratchet and socket set. So the cheaper ones don't have as many teeth on the cog. Look for something, I think, with at least 72 teeth. And that seems to be a pretty good number so that you can just have a little small click and you don't really need to move the wrench too far if you're in a really tight spot in order to get that bolt broken.
Is there any advice beyond what you've already spoken about? Obviously, we've just discerned that we don't want 12-sided sockets. We already kind of talked about the brands you like and the brands you avoid. What other advice would you give someone who is for the first time really starting to work on their own cars at home and starting to use socket sets, or using socket sets for other stuff around the house? It's not just automotive, I suppose.
That's true because you can use socket sets for a lot of stuff, whether it's furniture assembly. I mean, if you're living in a condo, there's all kinds of things that you can use a socket set for. Try to get a set that has both standard and metric sizes in it, because half inch versus 10 millimeter, stuff will be close, but it won't be spot on, and you'll end up rounding off your bolts and just making the a 5 minute job turn into a 5 hour job. So always look, yeah, right? You've been there too, Tim. So look for something that's got both of those. There are cheaper sets out there that only have one or the other, but I'm almost confident that you'll end up going and buying both anyways. Because
I mean, yeah, I mean, even though I don't really wrench on vehicles right now because I don't have the space to do it, I do have some hand socket sets here at my house, and I don't recall off top of my head. I'm not going to interrupt the podcast to go out and grab them out of my utility closet, but here in my little condo, I do have a couple socket sets that I use for around the house type stuff, and I believe they do have both standard and metric. But I have run into at times, using the wrong size, or maybe socket gets lost, or you have the wrong thing. So that this advice is really, really helpful to kind of get people to get the right stuff, because I think it sounds like common sense, but I think it really is true that the having the best tool available for the job will save you a lot of hassle and work in the long run.
Very much so. Having the right tool just makes life a heck of a lot easier. And you can make your own joke out of that if you want. But
No, there's no
one
joke there. I
other
think it's pretty obvious.
thing. But one other thing, I'll just sign off by saying the jokes are true. You are probably going to lose your 10 millimeter socket because it's
That's the
one of
most
the most.
popular one, right?
Absolutely. So the memes are true. Go out and buy a couple of extra 10 mils and you're golden.
Well, let me ask you this. Does it get lost because it's so popular and you're using it so much and you just don't put it away where it's supposed to? Or does it get lost because, as luck would have it, whenever you need it, you just can't find it? Is it a Murphy's Law thing, or is it a disorganization kind of thing?
For me, it's Murphy's Law, because I'll end up using the 10 mil more than anything else. So just by dint of statistics, it's going to get lost more frequently because I use it twice as much as anything else, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll drop it down in an engine bay, and then it's on, you know, an engine mount down there, and I can't get at it for love nor money. So it's rattling around for the next 100 years. Or I'm trying to break a bolt loose, and then everything goes flying when the bolt finally does come loose, and then I never see the socket again because of that instance. Or, like you said, man, sometimes it's just like, hey, I got a phone call or a text, or, you know, someone came home and I want to talk to them, and I just put my tool down, and the 10 millimeter is on it, and then it's gone when I come back.
Oh, yeah, see ya 10 millimeter.
Absolutely.
Well, Matthew, this has been really helpful. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it as always. And we will see you on the next time on the Truth About Cars podcast, talking about the stuff that we use. Thank you again, Matthew.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We're here on the Truth About Cars podcast with Alex Nizek from Consumer Reports. He is a manager of automotive testing and insights. Thank you for joining us today, Alex.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to it.
So he's on to discuss the top 10 cars that Consumer Reports came up with for 2024. Alex, before we get into that, can we talk a little bit about, tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess at first, you know, I'm a car enthusiast and I've just been passionate about cars for my entire life. So I, at this point, I'm getting to kind of live out my dream testing cars and being a part of what Consumer Reports does. So, you know, from that perspective, it's pretty amazing. But, you know, before that, I do have a background in mechanical engineering. And then I did get a go on to study automotive engineering specifically, which, you know, set me up, I guess, pretty well. And I did work at Ford for a little bit in the engineering department, you know, primarily working on touchscreen interfaces and ergonomics and things like this. Not necessarily, I suppose, where I expected to end up at Ford, but it really turned out to be a blessing in disguise in some ways after coming to Consumer Reports. You know, just as I'm sure you're aware, just the way cars are moving with the technology on the inside being so important and differentiating them with controls and usability and the user experience and things like that. So it really did provide a good perspective on that. But one thing I guess I'll, since I get to talk about me for a second, that I really do look back fondly on is in my grad school experience, we did this program called Deep Orange at Clemson University, which is basically like simulating a vehicle development you know, scenario just at a smaller scale and with students instead of in a professional environment. But we built an entire concept car. We actually worked with Mini and BMW and built an entire plug-in hybrid vehicle from the ground up, which was absolutely amazing. And just getting to experience, you know, all the engineering that goes inside of a vehicle and, you know, work at, you know, cutting edge technology and that type of thing. So a lot of cool stuff. And then certainly love what I'm doing now.
Excellent. Good to hear. So can you tell us kind of, we're here to talk about your top 10 cars. Can you kind of walk us through the process and tell us how that works? And because every automotive outlet does it a little bit differently. Just as an example, those of us at TTAC, we've done best and worst every year at the end of the year. And we do generally, we don't have a formal testing process. We just basically pull all the people who actually have access to test cars and ask them to say, hey, what was the best thing you drove, or what were the best three cars you drove, or whatever.
Right.
And change it up a little bit from year to year. So how does it work at Consumer Reports?
Yeah, you know, we try to be really consistent and regimented with what we're doing and how we're testing. And so we test a lot of cars each year. I mean, we, you know, I don't know the exact number, but at least 30 each year, but sometimes more, sometimes less. We actually just tested a lot more because we have been kind of diving deep into plug-in hybrids, as we'll talk about. We have about 50, a little bit more than 50 different, you know, subjective and objective testing that we do here at our test track in Connecticut. So that's kind of the foundation, right? All these cars go through The same tests, some of that is out on the test track, you know, with controlled surfaces for braking and acceleration and emergency handling and things like that. And then there's, of course, the subjective side of it in terms of, you know, ride and handling and usability of controls and things like that. So, you know, step one is really being the top of the category for performance and all of the things that we're looking for. And then after that, you know, the next two things are owner satisfaction. So we survey our members every year and find out who, you know, essentially who would buy their vehicle again and who's happy with it. And reliability is another huge component of what we do. So again, that comes from our member survey data. And then we're looking at historical data to essentially come up with, you know, projected reliability rating for these new cars. So that's a huge component of it. We know reliability is super important to consumers and people shopping for a new car. And then, you know, piece number four, if you will, is safety. So all these cars have to have standard forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking, you know, at a minimum. Of course, many of them have many things beyond that, but that's kind of the basis, you know, minimum qualification to get yourself on the list. So there's that. So all of that kind of comes together. But then to your point, you know, it's also a lot of us talking about these cars, experiencing these cars, living with them day to day. So, you know, and sharing opinions and trying to represent the consumer, of course, but there is that subjective component too, that, you know, basically all of these cars are something that if I had to recommend a car to a family member or a friend, you know, I'd have no problem doing that.
Excellent. Excellent. So you touched briefly upon electrification. So reading over the list here, by my count, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are seven, if we count the Prius and Prius Prime as the same model, there are seven electrified models. Now, for the sake of our listeners' clarity, most of our listeners understand what that means. But for those who don't, electrified does not mean electric vehicle necessarily. It can be a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid as well. Right. But I'm counting the Camry hybrid, Toyota Prius, Toyota Prius Prime, Ford Maverick hybrid, Toyota Highlander hybrid, Toyota RAV4 Prime, Tesla Model Y, and BMW X5 plug-in. So can you tell us why seven of your 10 are electrified?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think it really speaks to where the market is right now. I mean, we're, you know, our list and frankly, what we're testing is really trying to respond to the market, what consumers are looking for, what they're interested in. And also what we're trying to help people understand, and plug-in hybrids are certainly something that is a little bit of a mystical technology, if you will, that's out there. But, you know, just generally speaking with electrification, whether we're talking an EV or even just going down to a regular hybrid, these tend to be a lot quieter, a lot quicker in their acceleration. And then certainly, you know, most often anyway, more efficient than their gas only counterparts. So especially when you're talking about a regular hybrid vehicle, there's very few trade-offs most of the time. I mean, we've gotten to the point where the price premium to get into a hybrid, especially the ones on our list, is sometimes zero. Other times it's quite small. You know, we're talking a $1,500 price premium over the regular version. So there's really, you're not giving up a whole lot. You know, we can get into the details on the driving experience of some of these cars for sure. And, you know, a lot of the hybrids have an eCVT in them where, you know, maybe the gas version has a 8-speed or something like that. So there is a driving, you know, experience implication of going with a hybrid in most cases. But for most people who are looking for that efficiency and reliability, we see that hybrids are very reliable. They can be an awesome choice. And, you know, I think reliability might be a different discussion, broadly speaking, with plugins and pure BEVs. But you know, those comments, I guess, about acceleration and power and quietness and performance do kind of hold true for the other forms of electrification as well.
Excellent. So one thing I also noticed looking at the list is only three of this year's top picks are back from last year. That's the Subaru Forester, the Camry Hybrid, and the Maverick / Maverick Hybrid.
Right.
So for those who have not seen the Consumer Reports article, the new entrants are the new ones on the list are Model Y, Subaru Crosstrek, Mazda 3, Highlander Hybrid, RAV4 Prime, BMW X5 and X5 plug-in, and the two Prius family.
Right.
So can you tell me why it changed over so much this year? Only three out of 10 have carried on to another year?
Yeah, I mean, so you know, just to, I guess, to be clear, those three are ones that were repeat from last year, right? Those were on the list.
And so that's what I meant.
Consecutive.
I misspoke.
No, that's okay. And it's just, you know, it's a little confusing is all I'm trying to say on our end, really, is some of those vehicles have been on the list before. For instance, the Prius, right? And the Prius Prime. They've been on the list before, except for then they went through a redesign. And, you know, by the time we put out the list last year, we hadn't had a chance yet to test the Prius and the Prius Prime. So point being is vehicles come and go depending on whether they've been redesigned or not. And sometimes we just don't have, we don't have the data yet to say whether a vehicle is going to be reliable or not. Or certainly if we haven't tested it, right? So we don't want to go and say something's on the list if you know, historically it's been, but we haven't had a chance to check the new one yet. So that's why you kind of see some of the vehicles come and go.
That makes total and complete sense.
Yeah, yeah. I do think, you know, kind of, I guess, starting at the top of the list with the Model Y, I'm thinking about the electrification and going down from full BEV down to, you know, gas only. But we did have the Tesla Model 3 on the list last year. And, you know, great car, and reliability was strong enough to make it onto the list for our electric vehicle, you know, category. But now we see with the Model Y that the reliability has increased enough from our survey data that says, okay, now it's eligible to be on the list. And ultimately, from a vehicle standpoint, it's basically the Model 3, but more practical, right? You get more space, bigger cargo area, that type of thing. So scores a little better for us in that regard. So now that the reliability is similar between the two, we move the Model Y or the 3, excuse me, off. And now the Model Y is there in its place.
The other thing that stuck out to me looking at the list is, as you said in your press release, the six of the 10 cars are have a base price under 30K. Yeah, whereas an average new transaction price or the ATP is closing in on $50,000.
Yeah, yeah.
So does that factor in? Is there any, you know, is there any reason why there's so many cars that are under 30K, or is it just a coincidence?
Yeah, good question. I mean, we do try to, I mean, yeah, certainly there are a lot of vehicles that perform really, really well that have, you know, cost a lot more. But as we often see, you know, these vehicles that cost a lot more, they're redesigned more often per se, and have a lot more technology in them. Those are sometimes the things that go wrong and that, you know, kind of impact the reliability negatively. So it might have, you know, I'm just thinking about the Lucid Air, for example, just pulling a random example out of my head. Amazing car, right? Incredible technology. Performance is kind of next level. But if we don't have the satisfaction and the reliability to data there to support it, then, you know, it can't really make the list. So I think a lot of the cars that do come in under that $30,000 mark are cars that just, you know, despite their price, have strong reliability, satisfaction is really high. And, you know, we just know that people shopping for a new car, yes, there are the ones that are inflating that that average price up to that near $50,000 mark you mentioned, but there's still a lot of people that don't want to spend that much. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't want to.
Right.
So getting something and that under $30,000
spend too. I think we'd all love to spend $100,000 on a sports car.
Well, yeah, sure. I wish I was in the position to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you know that under $30,000 mark, it's the starting base price, right? We know people add options and whatnot, but really just shows people that you don't have to spend an arm and a leg to get a car that is great. And in the case, you know, we have the Mazda 3 on the list. I'm sure a vehicle you've driven before, and Mazda 10.
Not recently, but yeah. Oh, yeah.
The last one I drove was the turbo hatchback model a couple years ago, which was pretty sweet. Certainly not the cheapest version of the Mazda 3 that you can get, but you know, point being, it's just Mazda, that 3 shows that you don't have to spend a bunch to get a car that's not boring, you know.
It's right, nice, right,
good interior, looks nice. So yeah, I think you can option all these cars up beyond that $25,000 price. But
yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to say we would be remiss if we didn't mention that base price literally means base price.
Yeah.
You can get a Honda Civic over $30,000 if it's fully loaded.
Oh, no problem.
I believe a Sport Touring manual base is like 31 for the I think a sport manual is like 26, but if you want the nicer one, it's like 31. Right.
I was pricing
them the other day. That's what I do sometimes during my lunch hour. But yeah, and the Mazda 3 is a great example of that. That's a car that starts at a nice base price, but loaded up, it could get a little bit pricey.
Right.
Not even the Maverick, pricey, but it would be over 30.
Right.
Oh, yeah, the Maverick definitely the gets Maverick, a little pricey. I mean, you want to start loading options on for sure.
Yeah, and most people do, right? I mean, when that came out, I mean, even the base price of it when it came out, the whole deal was that it was going to be, you know, I forget what the...
I want to say it was $19,995.
Yes,
it was $5 under $20,000, just so you could say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we're 3 years into its lifespan and it starts at like, you know, 23 or something like that. And it's not the hybrid standard anymore.
Right.
So, yeah. So these things change. They increase over time. But yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while since I drove the Mazda 3 myself. I think it was like during the height of the pandemic was the last time I drove one, because I remember like we still weren't going a lot of places when I last time I had one. So I'd like to drive that car again.
Yeah.
Moving on to the list, we talked about why there's so few repeats. We also talked about why there's so many cars under 30,000. Yeah. Are there any key fall-offs from last year? You mentioned the Prius, and you said that, you know, the Prius wasn't available in time for testing. But outside of that, outside of vehicles that weren't the right timing, because they were being redesigned or relaunched or whatever. Were there anything that didn't really change, but it fell off just because either something else bumped it off or whatever reason?
Yeah, good question. It's a good question. Let's see. I think maybe the Corolla is a surprising one, getting displaced by, I believe the Crosstrek is what took its place. You know, it really just comes down to the performance of the car, right? You know, the Corolla being a small sedan, not as spacious as something like a Crosstrek, even though that's pretty small too. But comfort-wise, right, the Crosstrek just it rides really, really well for its. I don't know if you've driven the new one, but even the old one, right? That's Subaru not really changing their too much with their redesigns, right? So I think. You know, seeing the Corolla off the list is maybe a little bit surprising. But yeah, and then I think the Tesla Model Y is one that replaces the 3. And actually, you know what? A really interesting one is that we had the Nissan Leaf on the list last year. And the reason it's not there this year isn't actually at all because it's not a good car or a good EV. Yes, there are newer EVs coming out that are more technologically advanced and what have you, but it actually, a lot of it comes down to the fact that it has the CHAdeMO plug for fast charging, right?
Yep.
Not only was that already kind of on its way out to be replaced by CCS, the, you know, the combined charging that most EVs today have, but now with everything going on with the Tesla connector and the NACS connector, as you might hear it be called, it's just the future of being able to charge the Nissan Leaf out in at public chargers is pretty unknown. So we would be a little, it would be a little awkward to recommend that car, you know, even though it's still great otherwise.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Crosstrek. I've driven the Sport and the Premium last fall. I have a Wilderness scheduled for testing in a few weeks. So I've not driven the Wilderness. Okay. As far as the Leaf goes, I did have one over Thanksgiving weekend. I drove my parents' house in it. They live about an hour, 15 minutes away. Mm-hmm. And, charging it was a little bit of an issue. It was really slow to charge at their house. They don't have a EV charger or anything. And then I did find a CHAdeMO, but it was a good 15-20 minutes down the way. But at least it worked. It took a few different attempts to get everything to pair. My credit card wasn't pairing at first, and I had plenty of money in the car, so it wasn't that. But eventually it was like, I think the card was reading, and then the CHAdeMO wasn't talking to the car, and then the credit card wasn't reading, and then eventually third or fourth try, the card read, CHAdeMO connected to the car. It worked. I got a decent amount. I got enough charge to get home in like 20 minutes. So once it worked pretty well. But
Right.
Yeah. But it actually brings up a question for you guys. Now that EVs are becoming a bigger part of the market and plug-in hybrids as well, how much does the availability of charging, and like you mentioned with the Leaf, does sort of the charging plays into whether a car gets on that list or not? Not just the way the car drives and handles the convenience features and safety and all that?
Yeah, I mean, we're at a place right now with the charging situation that it inevitably has to be considered. I mean, we do a lot of testing and put a lot of information on our website about charging for EVs and plug-ins in terms of, you know, the the miles per, you know, X amount of time plugged in you can expect if you're on the, you know, 350 versus a 150 or 50 kilowatt or something like that. But the fact of the matter is right now, yes, with the Tesla Model 3 or the Y or any Tesla, it's literally changing as we speak and in front of our eyes. But with access to that supercharger network, there's just no denying the fact that it's an easier EV to live with, right? Than mm-hmm. if you're having to rely on Electrify America or, you know,
EVgo. I've heard more stories.
Yeah. I mean, I've experienced some myself. And so, yeah, the Tesla chargers just tend to be, you know, more reliable, certainly more prevalent. We know that. And also integrated with the vehicle super well, right? That's another thing we tested. And Tesla just, it's that Apple style ecosystem, right? That everyone talks about, and they've got that down. So that definitely is factored into why the Model Y is on the list and why the Nissan Leaf is not, you know, outside of, yes, the Y is a quicker, better handling vehicle than the Leaf. There's no doubt, but, and then the interesting thing about plug-in hybrids is, and it less so about being on the list specifically, but just what's interesting about them is you don't always have to install a level 2 charger in your house, right? If you're buying an EV, I guess technically speaking, you don't have to, but generally you want to install one of these quicker EV chargers in your house so that you can mm-hmm. charge it up overnight and get, you know, 20, 30 miles of range per hour plugged in. The batteries on these plugins are generally small enough, and you're talking, you know, 20, 30, 40 miles of range, where you can actually just get away with using the included charger that plugs into your regular, you know, 120 volt outlet in your house. And so that's one thing we're testing with these is how long will it take to fill up the battery just using the included charger? Don't need to do anything else extra or modify your house or even live in a house, really, if you don't want to. So, yeah, and then, of course, you have that gas engine to fall back on, even if it doesn't fully charge, right?
Right.
So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, when it comes to full battery electrics, the charging conversation is definitely interesting, especially for folks like me. I live in a high rise in a small condo.
Okay.
And I don't have – our building's older. We don't have at the present. I've heard some chatter among, you know, the gossip of when you own a condo, there's gossip among the HOA people. But there's been some talk about installing an EV charger or two. But right now we don't have that. We do have a charge point about a 10-minute walk away. That is, I'm in Chicago, so I'm in a fairly urban, densely packed area, densely built. Mm-hmm. And charge point, I don't want to jinx anything. I'm knocking on wood. You might hear on the mic there, but I'm knocking my wood table. But the charge point has worked fairly well so far when I've had to use it to plug in to charge full BEVs. But I've definitely heard Electrify America horror stories. So, yeah, charging is – I'm glad that we brought that up because charging is something that, you know, typically I wouldn't want an external factor to affect how a car is or isn't placed on top 10 list. But right now it does matter when you're shopping for – a full BEV or even a plug-in hybrid that you plan on actually charging. And if you're buying a plug-in hybrid and don't actually plan on charging it and just planning on driving it like a regular series hybrid, okay, whatever. But if you're going to charge it frequently and you don't have home charging, if you don't have the ability to get home charging in your house or your apartment building, charging does matter.
Right, it does. And yeah, with the plug-in hybrid, I mean, we find that you really do want to be charging them too, as much as you possibly can.
Well, yeah, you'd save on fuel. Absolutely.
Yeah. But you know, when you go to some of these Electrify America stations, I mean, in my own personal experience, you know, you'll show up to one and, you know, it's a 350 kilowatt charger. Maybe I'm showing up with a Hyundai Ioniq 5 that should be able to charge at 235 kilowatt or something like that. And you get there and, you know, the charging station screen says that the output of the charger is limited to due to bad weather. And you look around and it's like a sunny, cloudless, you know, summer day. And you're stuck there wondering why the heck the charger is stuck at like, you know, 40 kilowatt. And now your charge stop is twice as long as you thought it would be or something like that. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just you never know what you're going to show up to. And I think, you know, that's outside of the car's control, like you mentioned.
Right. So my final question for you, Alex, before we let you go is, all right, most auto journalism outlets do a best cars or a top 10 or something or top 5 every year. It's a little bit different for each outlet, but mm-hmm. most places do something. Very few do a worst cars. We actually do one. We don't, again, there's not a specific number. I think last year I asked my guys to pick just two or three, mm-hmm. and a couple guys picked only one. A couple guys picked like five because people don't always follow the rules. That's fine. But I was going to ask if there is a bottom 10. Do you guys do an official worst list? And if not, do you at least have in the back of your mind, like, man, if we did a bottom 10, these 10 cars would be
good. Yeah, right. It's a good question. I mean, we do put out like a best and worst new cars. It's not as, you know, I guess public or as impactful necessarily as, you know, what we're talking about with these top picks. Mostly comes down to cars that are the least reliable, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you know, frankly, there are so many cars, and I'm sure you might agree with this or experience it, is like so many cars are really good these days at doing most
things. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like just from a product perspective, they're amazing. So I think when you're thinking about the worst cars, you know, it's not that this car is just horrible overall or this one can't do something. For me, it comes down to something that a car does that annoys me on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. right? And something you just can't get away from. And I know you and Jake talked about this, so I don't want to be too unfair to this car, but the Alfa Romeo Tonale, and actually the Dodge Hornet too, mm-hmm. With the chimes on the inside of the car that, you know, it actually yells at itself for the headlights being on. So if you come into your garage or it's dark outside and you have the auto headlights on, when you open the door after shutting off the car, it starts beeping at you because the headlights are on. Even mm-hmm. though they're only on because the car turned them on itself. So just silly stuff like that.
Yeah. No, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. So just little things like that, that you can't really get away from or bug you on a daily basis. You know, I think there are some cars out there, you know, I'm really focused right now on electric vehicles and things like that. So there are some EVs that I think are a little, you know, half-baked in some ways, or disappointing in some ways. I'm thinking about, you know, the Nissan Ariya, for example. I won't say it's the worst car by any means, but, you know, it isn't the quickest to charge. The range is pretty good, but there's some other aspects of it that just aren't great, like visibility, for example. Mm-hmm. You look behind you and, you know, the rear window is really small and it's blocked by the camera that's protruding from the top of the hatchback. And then the window wiper is sticking up. And so just, you know, some of these aspects of these cars that just aren't so great, I suppose. And part of that is because so many cars do things so well that these little things start to become obvious, I suppose.
That makes a lot of sense for us. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was about to ask what you think the worst cars are, or what came up on your list.
Well, before I do that, let me kind of walk you through how we did it. So
we don't have the
ability to test reliability the way Consumer Reports does. We just don't. So reliability mm-hmm. didn't really matter as much to us as driving experience, because we are a little bit more enthusiast focused. Although mm-hmm. for me personally, a lot of it comes down to not how a car drives, but what a car does compared to its competition. So a lot of cars that I thought were bad were not necessarily bad in a vacuum. They were fine on their own, but they didn't measure up to either their price mm-hmm. or the competition. Okay. So we have a long list, and the one common car among the several writers who contributed to the list was the, unsurprisingly, the BZ4X, which I personally thought was not a terrible vehicle, but it's not nearly as good as anything it competes with. And that's part of the problem I ran into. I was also disappointed. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think we're looking at this in a very similar way, right? Like mm-hmm. these vehicles are all good at being a car in most ways, right? But yeah, exactly to your point, like especially with these EVs, looking at them compared to what Tesla's doing or anybody else, right? I totally see what you mean about the BZ4X. I mean, I think it drives actually pretty well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be unhappy owning one, but you can just do better for the money.
Right. Agreed.
And for me, my other two, and I won't go through our entire list. We don't have time for that, unfortunately. But my other two were the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe Trailhawk. That sounds like, oh, my God, the Grand Cherokee. I love the Grand Cherokee. It's one of my favorite vehicles. And if I needed a 5-seat crossover SUV that could do a little bit of off-roading and had the money for one, I would totally buy one. But I don't know if I'd buy the 4xe, partly because the expectations were really high. And it also requires you to get the Trailhawk trim, which is expensive. And then... Mm-hmm. the hybrid transitions, at least in the ones I drove, and I was on the launch, and I also drove one here at home, the transitions were not smooth between gas and hybrid, as smooth as they should be. And that was bothersome since hybrid technology is not exactly new. So if that was a little bit, if that car was a little bit better baked or available at a lower price point or a lower trim level, it would not be on the list.
Yeah.
It just was not something I would buy. I'd rather buy a gas engine Grand Cherokee.
Yeah.
And finally for me, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to comment on the Grand Cherokee. We did test one fully recently, the 4xe, and yeah, totally agree. I mean, I think, you know, some of it seems to be, you know, with these plug-in hybrids especially, there's so many different ways that you can execute them with where you put the motor and the battery and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So trying to take a longitudinal layout, rear-wheel drive with a drive shaft, and implement this plug-in hybrid. Yeah, you know, they've got that motor in the torque converter position before the 8-speed, and then the battery, if you look under the car, the battery pack is actually like a saddle over the exhaust and the drive shaft running through the car. It's just immensely complicated. I think it has about 1,000 pounds on the the regular V6 that we also tested. So, and totally agree that the transitions, it's just not the smoothest. And, you know, I think for me with a plug-in hybrid, the easier it is to drive it in the EV mode without the engine coming on, right? Like that's a reason you probably purchased a plug-in hybrid, is to take advantage of the EV driving, right? So it needs to accelerate well in EV mode, have enough range, and just, you know, compared to some of the other plug-in hybrids that we tested, it's just not quite there.
Right. And just to clarify before I give you my last of the three worst cars that I picked last year, it's not that you need the Trailhawk trim. You know, if you want the powertrain, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. If you want the Trailhawk trim, you have to get a 4xe.
Yeah, right.
So exactly. I said it backwards before, and that's my fault. I had my brain just tripped over itself. and then finally, it was actually a 2022 model, but it hasn't changed at all. Okay. I picked the Audi Q4 e-tron, and again, it's actually on its own a good vehicle.
Right.
But the price tag, it was like, ooh, right? And I had no problems with the vehicle itself. Like, if you gave me one for free and you said you have to drive this for 5 years, I'd be very happy. Mm-hmm. But the problem is I wouldn't want to sign that payment every month for what they were asking. And again, like I said, you know, there are really, truly very bad cars. And even the true bad cars on the market, like the Mitsubishi Mirage, at least the Mirage is bad for a reason. It's bad because it's inexpensive. It's bad because it's inexpensive. And it's basic, and that's fine. Those who buy it know what they're getting.
Yeah,
you get an Audi Q4 e-tron, you're expecting a little more luxury for the price, and it really didn't differentiate itself from the lesser vehicles it's based on. So that's what kind of bothered me with that car.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, one thing I do, I guess, like about the Q4, well, there's two things that come to mind. One, from a controls, like in usability perspective, it's not totally out of this world, right? It does kind of feel like a regular Audi, so which is good. They do a good job. Totally small detail. I also really like the cup holders in the door. They're huge and like pointed at you, so you can just drop your bottle in there or whatever. But I have thinking about the price of, you know, got ours pretty early on and sitting there looking at it after driving it and thinking about the price, and kind of bothers me that you look at the rear wheels and you see a drum brake through the rear wheels. I mean, I know why they did it, and the ID4 is the same way, but you know, to your point, it's just like, does this really feel like I spent you know, $60,000 or whatever it is. I totally get that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, I thought the interior materials just weren't up to snuff for that price.
For
$10,000 less, I'd been okay. But for 65 or 60, yeah. 64 and six, almost 65 for what my test vehicle was.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the one we bought for testing was somewhere in that ballpark too.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, again, I think, you know, for me, there's very few really, truly bad cars, as you said, and as I've said as well. I think what it really comes down to is that most of the cars that are quote-unquote bad just either are overpriced, at least at MSRP, and we all know MSRP is a suggested retail price. People can negotiate down, so that is a caveat that needs to be factored in. But also, there's just a lot of cars either just don't match their mission or they don't match their competition. And I think that to me is when I'm reviewing cars, that's one thing I think of a lot too, is like, this car on its own, pretty good, but is it good enough for the money that they're asking a sticker price? And is it good enough that I would buy this over its direct competitors? That's something that I factor in a lot as well.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, especially in some of these segments where you just have so many options, right? It's like, to your point again about the Q4, why would I put $65,000 down on this car when I can go get a Tesla or even one of the Hyundai Kia Genesis models that
or a Mustang Mach-E?
Yeah, exactly, right? It's just, it doesn't quite, I don't know, you gotta have a stronger showing than that, I think, in this day and age.
I agree. Well, Alex, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. This has been fun.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Your elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love have transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive entirely its own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. With eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber and not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only and exclusions apply. So thanks again to listening to the Truth About Cars podcast. Today, our guests were BJ Burtwell, the founder and CEO of Electrify Expo, and Alex Nizek, the manager of automotive testing and insights from Consumer Reports. BJ was on to discuss electrification in the automotive industry, while Alex went over Consumer Reports' top 10 for 2024. That's all for today. I am Tim Healy, the managing editor for The Truth About Cars. That's TTAC.com, TTAC.com, or TheTruthAboutCars.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.